Live from Studio 23 in Corvallis, Oregon, this is Super Cinema, the comic book podcast where we break down the movies that comic books have created. I'm your host, Ben Hamlin. Today we're joined by special guest host,
Ian Butcher.
Ian, welcome back to the show. Fans of the show, you may notice that Donald Orr is missing. Fear not, he is not dead. He is alive and well, he's just super busy right now. So he had to step away from the mic for a couple of months, in which case, Mr. Ian Butcher will be filling in for the next couple of months to help us break down comic book movies. Today we're talking about The Dark Knight Rises, and for this we have a special guest, live from the other side of the country. Please welcome...
Hey guys, it's me, Daryl, Seed on Twitter. Glad to be here. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Absolutely, we're glad to have you on the show. So today we're talking about The Dark Knight Rises, concluding our part three of the trilogy of Bat movies. That is, after Batman Begins with Bubba Wheat and The Dark Knight with Kevin Veldman. So Dark Knight Rises, guys, this movie got a little bit of flack back in the day for basically not being The Dark Knight. But where do you guys stand on it? Do you guys think it holds up? Just a real brief kind of opening remarks. Daryl, I'll start with you.
Yeah. I think it holds up, man. At first, when I first saw the movie, when it came out in 2012, I think it was, everyone expected it to be The Dark Knight Part 2, basically. So it was coming off of an almost insurmountable setup of hype that it couldn't top it no matter what they did. And I was one of the people that was on the train of it's not good, you know. They fell flat and they dropped the ball the last moment in the last movie. But upon retrospect, having seen it again recently for this show, it stands on its own legs. It has its own merit, and I think a lot of people should go back and rewatch just this movie without watching Batman Begins or The Dark Knight, and they might find that it holds up better than people think it does.
Absolutely. Ian, what do you think?
I'm in kind of a similar boat, probably more enthusiastic about my thoughts about the movie. I absolutely love this movie, and I have since it first came out in 2012. And to what you're saying about it not being The Dark Knight again, that's the thing both then and now that I really love about it, is that it is its own movie. In much the same way that The Dark Knight isn't Batman Begins, The Dark Knight Rises isn't The Dark Knight.
Yeah, absolutely. It's important to distinguish that, and sometimes comparisons hurt a film, but we'll get into that in greater detail. But first things first, let's talk about a little bit of comic book movie news. So, Ian, you appear to be more in the loop than I do. Let's hear you talk about that. Let's hear you talk about that Wolverine stuff.
Yeah, so this morning there was a poster that dropped on the internets for the upcoming third and what we're assuming is the final Wolverine film, or at least the final one with Hugh Jackman in the lead role. And today on Twitter, the first poster dropped, revealing the title of the movie. It's going to be called Logan. And as well, at the same time, James Mangold, who directed the last Wolverine film and is directing this one, also posted on Twitter the second page of the script, which you can read and just kind of get a nice little sense of a little taste of what the movie's going to be. Movie comes out in March. Everybody involved has already said it's going to be rated R. This is going to be Hugh Jackman's last go around as Wolverine, and they've said it's going to be a very, very, very different movie than any of the ones we've seen before. And from everything I've been hearing, it sounds like there'll probably be an actual trailer dropping within the next couple of weeks, which seems fair, seeing as how the movie is coming out in March, and this is our first time seeing or hearing anything about it.
Yeah, no, that sounds about right. Yeah, so this will be his last performance as Wolverine for the fifth time.
Yeah, but no, I'll go for it.
Oh, I swear that guy's just tried to quit like four times already. It's because look, I mean, I remember hearing when X-Men Origins Wolverine was going to be his last performance as Wolverine, but then they roped him in for another three movies.
Well, I feel like with this one, with everything he's been saying and what it sounds like the movie's going to be, which is Old Man Logan, I think I'm pretty safe in assuming that this is probably going to be it for him.
Nah, and it's the end of a trilogy.
I guess.
Hollywood loves trilogies. Yeah, interesting. Interesting that they have to name it Logan.
Well, I think that's actually, you know, what you were saying about it being a trilogy, which I don't really see it as, because I don't see the Wolverine as a sequel to X-Men Origins Wolverine. I just see it as another movie that has Wolverine in the lead. And so I feel like calling that movie The Wolverine, and then having this follow-up that's also directed by James Mangold, and having this one called Logan, I feel like kind of helps with what they've been saying about how, you know, this movie is going to be simultaneously cut from kind of a similar cloth as The Wolverine, as far as it being a very kind of down-and-dirty Wolverine movie, but also being a very different movie in tone and in style, you know. And with this movie, they've talked about how, you know, unlike the last movie, which was in Japan, this is going to be set in the future, and it's going to be the Old Man Logan storyline, and Patrick Stewart's going to be in this movie, so it's going to have a very different kind of vibe about it, and very focused on Logan, which is why, you know, the movie is called Logan.
Well, I hope you're right. Daryl, what do you think? Are you a fan of the last Wolverine movie?
Oh, that's one of those movies it's right there in the middle of the pack for me. It's obviously far better than the X-Men Origins movie. But that's not really all that hard to top I was very ambivalent about the second The Wolverine. It's, you know, it followed the Claremont, I guess it kind of followed the Claremont Wolverine in Japan storyline that is one of his, you know, more highly thought of besides Old Man Logan. It was good enough to get me to go back to the theaters for this last one, I guess is the best way to put it. I had my problems with it, but there are also some things that I kind of dug, like the whole fight on top of the train sequence was very well done, I think. So when I think of that movie, the action and the fight scenes definitely stand out for me. Some of the development I thought was a little bit weak, but it's enough to get me back into the theaters to check out this, you know, obviously Old Man Logan run. I'm all for it. Why not? Plus, it's gonna be rated R, so I think they can finally cut loose a little bit with what they can do with Wolverine.
I've got to agree with your sentiments 100%. That's pretty much how I felt about the movie as well. That it was just kind of middle ground. Like, look, I enjoyed it. I especially enjoyed that fight scene. I enjoyed his interactions with a lot of those characters. But really, for the most part, I kind of forgot about it. I don't think right now I could tell you much of the plot that wasn't action scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely remember his final siege of his final siege of like their castle and the subway fight. But other than that, not so much.
Well, and I feel like the thing, at least for me, that makes me the most interested to see this movie, tying back to, you know, what we're going to be talking about today with The Dark Knight Rises, is the fact that everybody going into this movie is approaching this as if this is the end. You know, which is something that we don't get a lot of in these comic book movies, is a really true sense of finality. And so that's the thing going into this that fascinates me the most, is that they're treating this as the end of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. That's going to be interesting, seeing how they're playing with continuity in that one. Since obviously this is going to be, hypothetically speaking, the end of the original timeline. And I can't believe I have to discuss original timelines in movies now.
Well, no. Technically, again, because I know the X-Men movie continuity is about as screwy and nonsensical as the comic book continuity.
But almost more so.
but this movie does take place in the new reset future.
Even though Patrick Stewart's in it?
Well, yeah, because at the end
You're right, you're right.
Yeah, at the end of Days of Future Past, yeah. So it is and it isn't, you know, is kind of the weird thing. So you'll still have Patrick Stewart and all that, but it is going to be set in the new timeline.
Yikes.
So, yeah, just...
you know what? That's all I've got until I see a trailer. Until I see a trailer, that's all I'm going to have to say. Just yikes.
Look, at this point, I've kind of given up on trying to, like, work out the continuity from X-Men film to X-Men film. I just want when I sit down to watch an individual film in that series, I just want it to be good. You know?
Well, I have no doubt that this is going to be something special.
Oh, yeah.
All right, let's move over to Luke Cage. Guys, how far in are you? Has anyone finished it yet?
Oh, yeah, I'm all done. I actually set my alarm clock for 3 a.m. just to make sure I was up in time for right when it hit Netflix. And I managed to watch a couple episodes before I went to work that day. And then spent the rest of the weekend knocking it out. I put it at number three, I think, of the four actual shows they've put out. The two Daredevils, Luke Cage and Jessica Jones. I'm putting it at number three, I think. But they're all very closely combined. It's not like there's a huge disparity between, you know, my number two pick and my number three pick. It's very hard to rank those. But Luke Cage was excellent.
Yeah, I've got to put it in roughly the same place. I finished it as well. I'd say it's actually maybe number two. I think I like it a little better than Jessica. But you know what? I think maybe both kind of deserve a rewatch for me, even though I just finished Luke Cage. Man, that is an engaging show. Like truly, I feel I need to watch it a second time just because I feel like there's a lot of little details in there that I feel I might have missed the first time. But yeah, it's really engaging and it's really compelling, and I'm really enjoying it. Or excuse me, enjoyed it. I finished it. Ian, how are you?
Oh, now you're making me feel bad because I'm only three episodes in.
Oh well, let us know when you can join us at the big kid table.
No, I will. Well, the problem is that, you know, the show started right before October, and October is when I stop everything else and watch nothing but horror movies. So I've been trying to balance both of those out of watching, you know, all my usual year end list of horror films while trying to power through Luke Cage, and it's not working out very well so far, but. The three episodes that I have seen, I am head over heels in love with this show. It's the just everything about it, the writing, the cinematography, direction, cinematography. You know, and it really hit me, you know, a couple episodes in that honestly, and it's fitting that we, you know, talk about this on a Nolan Batman episode, but this show, it's almost less of a superhero show, and it reminds me more of something like The Wire.
Mm-hmm.
Where it just happens, the lead character just happens to be superpowered.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's more of a character study of who Luke Cage is. A character study of a person and the ideals that make up that person. And that person just so happens to have superpowers.
Exactly, yeah.
Which, that's a great take on it, because certainly we've had enough superhero movies that are literally just, you know, strong man in cape fights, you know, evil genius or whatever. You know, we've had enough of the, I guess I'm describing Superman movies. You know, but we've had enough, like, you know, just cut and dry superhero movies that we really do need to dive deeper and deeper into interesting characters who happen to be superpowered. You know, like Luke Cage, like Jessica Jones last year. And like that kind of character development and that kind of character building, like, really helps create a story that's, you know, different. And isn't a hype, you know, a sixth Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
Although, well, I am looking forward to the sixth Spider-Man movie.
You and me both, man. But yeah, it's interesting, you know, you say that because we are at that point with superheroes, superhero movies, and now TV, where they've been around for long enough that if they want to continue to survive, audiences want to continue to enjoy them, they need to evolve past just being one guy in a cape fighting another guy in a cape. And I feel like stuff like what they're doing on Netflix is a great way to kind of help evolve that genre and keep it from being stale, you know, both with, you know, having the time allotted with 13 hours to tell a really gripping, you know, kind of ensemble character story, but also just, you know, setting it in Harlem, you know, giving it that character and that life and that vibrancy that you wouldn't find in a 2-hour movie, because they have that time on TV to give it that character and that charm. It really goes a long way.
Yeah, speaking of vibrancy, like, man, that show is well lit. That is some gorgeous lighting. All the scenes in you're far enough in. Like all the scenes in Harlem's Paradise are just gorgeously lit.
Yeah.
I'm a sucker for good lighting. I really am. but yeah, no, you're absolutely right. The show goes above and beyond in character growth. Yeah, I look forward to hearing what you think at the end. Which obviously we cannot discuss on this program. the show only came out a week ago.
I've heard it's very good, so I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Daryl, would you say it was really good?
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely very good. For me, it resonates deeply, being, you know, a person of African American descent. It's nice to see, you know, characterization of, you know, how how that whole neighborhood, you know, survives and thrives and moves and operates is something that I'm very used to. So I have a connection. I have an in there. Somebody, the people, actually, it's more than just Luke Cage that I can sympathize and empathize with. They knew what they were doing with this series, especially with the teasing us of certain elements of things that we thought were going to happen, and they didn't quite happen, that they'll probably wait until season two to do. You know, it's always great to see Claire, the night nurse, pop up all over these. I feel like wherever she is where the trouble goes. So this is really, maybe it's really an overall study of the night nurse and her surroundings. So yeah, it was well lit, well shot, very well acted. The action scenes are amazing. As amazing as it could very well be boring with just a big dude who punches things versus, you know, another big dude that punches things. That action could get very stale, but they find ways to make sure that it is not that. It could have very well been old Obi-Wan Kenobi versus Darth Vader, just two old men circle around each other in episode 4, but they managed to give it life and vibrancy.
Gosh, that would have been so bad. Yeah.
It is everything I hoped it would be. The soundtrack, for a person who's a fan of hip-hop and R&B.
Oh my god.
The soundtrack is an 11 out of 10. Everything that wasn't hip-hop is something that hip-hop has sampled. So it was excellently done all around.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Well, without spoiling anything, I think we should move on from there. Although I've got to say, conflict-wise, because we were talking about big dudes punching each other, Luke Cage does a great job of creating a conflict that can literally just not be solved by brute force. Like, the issues and problems run deeper than just being able to punch it out. And that's always very compelling. Because that was obviously the case in Daredevil as well, where Daredevil just couldn't just beat the shit out of corruption. Like, he had to do something about it as well.
He sure tried.
And this kind of carry... Yeah, well, he sure tried. Well, that's because Matt only has one attack plan. And it's ninja shit. ninja shit doesn't always work.
Unfortunately.
He took down crime and corruption. He just used a chain.
Yeah, exactly. Ian, did you ever hear that joke that was just like, what are you talking about? I don't kill anyone. The man I just knocked down 12 flights of stairs is fine.
Yeah. It's kind of like how in Batman Begins, he swears not to become an executioner. And then immediately blows up the League of Shadows headquarters, probably killing an extra 30 to 40 people.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, so we're on the same page about that.
Oh, yeah.
All right, on that note, let's take a quick break and come back to talk about The Dark Knight Rises. We work tirelessly to make this show and others free and accessible to listeners. So if you like what we do here at Infinity Break and you want to support us, there's a very easy way to do that. We have a Patreon at patreon.com/infinitybreak. If you want to chip in a monthly donation to help us keep this show and all of our comics, podcasts, and videos running and improving with each month, we'd greatly appreciate your show of support. Right now, we're working on improving the audio quality for both our videos and our podcasts, as well as developing new shows that are coming out in the next couple of months, including new podcasts, new comedy sketches, and new web series. We hope that you're just as excited as we are about the future of Infinity Break, and we're hoping that you can be a part of it. Once again, that's patreon.com/infinitybreak, and every donation helps. Thanks for listening, and as always, tell your friends. And now, back to the show.
You know, actually, I was just going to open with a Bane impersonation, but I don't know if my voice is healthy enough to do that. Let's just talk about The Dark Knight Rises. Ian, do you want to try it?
Give me a line. Feed me something.
You think darkness was your ally?
You think darkness was your ally? That's horrible.
You know what? It was better than I could do. Daryl, do you want to give it a shot?
Nope, not even going to try.
Not even going to touch that?
I know my pain is terrible.
You know, I feel extra shame having failed that, because about 3 weeks ago, I got the chance to watch all three of these movies in a movie theater. Alamo Drafthouse is holding a Dark Knight trilogy marathon. They showed all three of the movies on 35mm. And before this movie, before Rises started, they had a Bane quote-off with members of the audience, which I won. I won a poster. That makes me feel awful, though, that I totally fucked that one up.
All right, well, we'll remember that in spirit as we talk about The Dark Knight Rises, the third movie in the Christopher Nolan trilogy of Bat films. This came out about 4 years after The Dark Knight, stars Tom Hardy as Bane, and, of course, Christian Bale as Batman. It's another ensemble movie, you know, set in the heart of Gotham. It focuses on a number of different plot lines, your classic Nolan twists, fantastic lighting, and a really compelling multi-layered plot. However, this movie received, as we discussed in the beginning, a lot of flack, and it's often considered, you know, not the greatest follow-up to the movie that immediately predated it. But that's a discussion for a little later in this episode as we talk about the legacy of the Nolan movies overall. But, you know, first things first, right off the bat, let's just talk about The Dark Knight Rises as it is. Ian, you said you were a massive fan of the movie. What do you think makes this movie interesting?
What I think makes this movie interesting is, in many ways, what we were saying earlier, is the fact that this isn't The Dark Knight, you know, and that the temptation would have been with, you know, a follow-up to a film as masterful, as successful, you know, and as well-loved as The Dark Knight to merely do that again. But the thing that really, especially this last time watching the movie, that really stood out to me was the fact that watching all three of the movies in close succession, you really realize that how each movie is its own genre in and of itself. How Batman Begins is this, you know, Dickensian, almost, it's weird to say rags to riches story because we're talking about a billionaire. But yeah. It is kind of a, you know, following Bruce Wayne from his humble beginnings and watching him become a man and, you know, kind of embracing, you know, his calling and all that. And then The Dark Knight is a crime epic. You know, it's like Heat. You know, it's this just, you know, gritty crime film about a city. And The Dark Knight Rises is like the Lawrence of Arabia of Batman movies. It's like a David Lean film. It's the biggest, it's the gaudiest, it's the pulpiest, you know, it's the most emotional. It's the most comic booky, but it does that. It's the most comic booky, but we're not without breaking the reality that the previous two movies had set forward. And so while being kind of this huge, you know, epic, it in many ways is kind of the reverse of Batman Begins, because while Batman Begins was all about the creation of this myth, all about building up what Batman is and showing you step by step, this is what makes Batman what he is, The Dark Knight Rises is in many ways kind of a deconstructionist Batman movie, because the whole movie is about boiling down Batman to what it is at its absolute core and taking everything away from it, taking Bruce Wayne out of Gotham, taking away his money, taking away the suit, taking away his physical ability, you know, taking away Alfred, stripping away all of these things that you associate with Batman so that you can get to the true core of what Batman as a character, Batman as an idea is, so that then you can then build that back up at the end of the movie and for the characters be able to leave this story on a positive note that, you know, even though Bruce Wayne might not be Batman anymore, the idea of Batman is going to live on.
Yeah, you're right in that sense that it really is a deconstruction. I mean, you know, for a good chunk of the movie, he's literally just a bearded dude in a jumpsuit with a broken back. Like, you know, every part of him as Batman has been stripped away. And that does make for a really interesting and compelling character moment when he's trying to fight his way out of the pit. Fight in the sense to survive. He doesn't actually get in any prison brawls. Although I would not put it past him, considering how Batman Begins opens. Daryl, what do you think, though? What makes this movie compelling for you?
I mean, a lot of points that Ian touched on are the same thoughts as I had. It really is a deconstruction of Batman in the sense that I feel like it's more of a Bruce Wayne story than it is a Batman story, because you don't get a whole lot of Batman in this movie. He doesn't suit up really, I think, until 45, 50 minutes in. And after that, mm-hmm. he's in and out, Whereas I think maybe The Dark Knight is when you see him in the suit as Batman the most. So I feel like it's more of a Bruce Wayne story than it is Batman and him trying to juggle that life. And when you take away all those... You take away all his tools, and he didn't have the Batmobile, and, you know, he has the copter only for a little bit, and there's no Alfred there to help him out, and it's how is Bruce going to handle this situation is the way I look at it. My struggle with this movie is trying to figure out what the central theme is, because, you know, you guys talked about on the Batman Begins podcast that fear is the central theme for Batman Begins. I feel chaos is the central theme for The Dark Knight, the Joker's external mm-hmm. chaos and pretty much everybody else's internal chaos. I'm not sure what the if I had to pin down a theme in one word, what the theme of this movie would be. But that being said, it's, you know, it's got the great set pieces. The ending, I still have a little bit of problem with. I feel it's a little bit too on the nose for Alfred to say, I always had this dream of blah, blah, blah. And of course, that's exactly what happens in the very end. But other than that, you know, it's still a solid flick. It still holds up. Nolan put in a lot of good work on this movie. Brought back all the familiar faces. We, you know, obviously everybody loves seeing one scene with Dr. Crane in there as a haggard judge. There's plenty of good Easter eggs and things like that in there, though.
Yeah, I gotta say, look, I'm a fan of any Batman movie that includes more Scarecrow.
Yes, yes.
That's what I hold on to in this life.
He is my favorite of all three movies. He's actually besides Joker, Scarecrow is my favorite Batman villain.
I could not agree more, sir. No, I really like Scarecrow, and it was fun seeing his role in this movie as some sort of weird, like, Dr. Seuss-like judge of terror. And his, like, giant mountain of desks, like, dispensing justice.
Yeah, I love that. It's interesting.
No, Ian, go ahead.
I was just going to say that, you know, you said that you weren't sure what to boil down the theme of this movie is to one word. But it's, you know, in the way that Batman Begins is about fear, Dark Knight is about chaos. This movie, and it really struck me this last time I watched it, is very much about pain.
Hmm.
You know, physical pain, emotional pain. And,
oh, sure.
And really the whole point of what the villains are doing in this movie, this huge, crazy plot that they're pulling off, is all about, you know, putting Bruce Wayne through as much pain as humanly possible. You know, and all about breaking him.
I can agree with that. That makes a lot of sense. As soon as you said pain, I was like, oh, of course that makes perfect sense.
And that's, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that because there are, of course, I mean, look, obviously that dude starts the movie with a broken leg, goes into the third act of the movie with a broken back. but, you know, recovery. You know, throughout, like, he has to deal with issues of the severe emotional trauma that he has endured himself, the emotional trauma that he's inflicted on the city, because obviously 8 years later and they're still reeling from the whole Harvey Dent murder, as well as issues like, I mean, he has that entire conversation with Talia al Ghul about, you know, their past, and isn't there a discussion of scars, jog my memory?
Yeah, when they sleep together, he notices there's a brand, well, what looks like a scar, but if you pay attention, is actually a brand, which the brand that she has on her back is the same brand that Bane, if you notice, has on his forehead, which is the same brand in Batman Begins that they were going to use on, the League of Shadows is going to use on the one guy that they wanted to execute.
Oh, no, I didn't notice that at all.
Oh, there are so many little things that I picked up watching all three of these movies at once, especially in Rises. There are so many, like, tiny little nods and connections back to the other movies that you would never notice otherwise.
That's Nolan for you.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, pain itself is a big factor in Bane's character overall, considering he's got the mask to protect himself from that pain. And you know what, Ian, you said earlier that this movie is maybe the most comic booky, and I've got to agree because it has the most absurdist concepts.
But it works.
No, it certainly does. Yeah. Well, like, Batman Begins obviously has an ancient temple full of ninjas hidden in the Himalayas, and look, that's pretty comic booky in and of itself. But this movie, you know, also has an entire plot with, like, three trucks going around the city carrying a nuclear reactor that was part of a clean energy project that could destroy the world if a single person leaves Gotham, and Scarecrow's running his weird, like, court in the middle of City Hall on a giant mountain of desks. Like, it's got some weird Bronze Age, some weird Silver Age. Like, it's just a mishmash of, like, cool Batman elements and story. And, you know, obviously the bat jet shows up in an interesting way that fits in with the time period. And actually, that's the Nolan aesthetic. That's what this whole movie does, really, is it takes these kind of more absurdist concepts and it brings them back to the world of, like, you know, paid mercenaries and Wall Street deals that you get in a Dark Knight movie. You know, it manages to bridge the gap between the two of them while keeping these weird concepts, but still finding a way to ground them into this world that we've come to know over the course of three movies. And I think it does a really good job in that respect.
Yeah, because that's the thing is if you actually, like, start talking about the villain's plot in this movie, it sounds insane. Like, you know, it's, you know, okay, we're gonna re-infiltrate every level of Gotham's infrastructure. We're going to lay concrete laced with explosives all around the city to isolate the island off from the outside world. And then we're going to, you know, kidnap this, you know, Russian scientist so he can, you know, yeah, like, you know, retrofit this, you know, fusion reactor. Like, it's bonkers, but when you watch it, it you totally buy into it.
How can I forget?
Yeah, the villains, the whole plot is very James Bondian.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
In that sense. And, but on a smaller level, you know, everybody talks about Bane and Talia al Ghul. The tertiary villain, John Daggett, I think had a very credulous plot to take down Bruce Wayne, just to snatch the fingerprints, use that fingerprint identity to do some reckless stock activity and completely bankrupt him. That seems very credible to me. And I feel like since the light has always shined on Bane and his Ernst Stavro Blofeld type plots, that one is the one that kind of falls by the wayside and people talk about this movie. And rewatching, I got a whole new respect for just how slimy Daggett was and what he was trying to do in his own little crime world as well.
I'm glad you mentioned Bond, because I think the best description I ever heard of Bane was every Bond villain mixed down to one audio track.
I gotta say, I don't know how you guys feel about it, but I love that voice.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. No, me too.
It's so weird and kind of off-putting, because it's totally not what you would expect to come out of that guy's mouth, you know. But it works, because it does just sort of, like, put you on edge, and you're kind of like, okay, what the hell is this guy gonna do? Like, he sounds like some, you know, like, posh English gentleman, you know, not like this muscle-bound, you know, maniacal madman.
I think, yeah, from what I remember hearing when the movie first came out or was about to come out, that was all Tom Hardy's idea. He tried on a couple of different voices, and because I guess he has damn near a different voice in every movie he plays. That's his thing, I guess. And that accent makes absolutely no sense for the character, and that's why it's perfect for the character.
Yeah, it's a defiance of expectations, and it really works.
Well, and it's interesting. I don't know how in depth, you know, scene by scene you want to go with the movie, Ben, but you know, you talk about the James Bond thing, and that's really evident just from the opening scene, you know, which is basically the opening of a James Bond film.
Yes.
And I mean that, like, with the utmost praise.
Yeah, well, actually, the actual opening scene is just that very brief speech by Commissioner Gordon, where he's talking about the Dent Act. And I thought that was a great way to open the movie, because that's the only connection we really need to The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know what, the entire bit where they're talking about, you know, the entire bit, I know it cuts away to the plane and then comes back a bit later. But that entire bit where they're just talking about, like, oh, the mayor's going to dump him in the spring, that kind of stuff, that's maybe only 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And that does a great job of just tying us to the continuity of the previous movie, remembering where we were, etc., and then just moving forward. We don't really need an explanation of where the Joker went. We don't really need an explanation of, like, how many other villains have popped up. We just need to know, like, things are better now. Gotham has changed. That's really all we need to know, you know, right there at the top before we can kick in to the action where we see a villain that is looking to upset that balance.
And the thing that I love about that opening is, on top of the fact that just from a set piece standpoint, it's incredible. You know, is the fact that that movie or that scene is in many ways kind of a mission statement for the entire movie. You know, that scene is just going, okay, we're going to be big, we're going to be just grandiose and just go for it, you know, all while simultaneously, you know, setting all the pieces in motion of this movie of, okay, here's Bane, this is what he's about, this is, we're going to start to get introduced to his plot, you know, and it does a really great job of, within 7 minutes, you know, in total, setting the tone, setting in motion the characters and the plot and everything in a very, very clean and economical way, on top of giving you this insane, insane action scene.
Yeah, before we even know what Bane's true plan is, we just know that he's an extremely capable tactician right off the bat. That, you know, this guy's obviously a physical threat to the FBI and CIA agents on the plane, but also that this guy has, like, all sorts of, like, you know, backups and twists to his plan. You know, the whole thing where he's like, you know, no, I'm not going to try the accent.
They expect one of us in the wreckage. Stay behind, brother.
You know,
that was pretty good. That was
thank you. Right. Thank you. All right. You know, when he sends that other guy to die in the plane wreckage, you know, when he does the blood transfusion mid-air, you know, like, the fact that his plan isn't just to hijack that plane and, like, crash it, that his plan is to steal that plane in the air.
I love it. Love it.
You know, like, we just get right off the bat, like, this guy is not a criminal. This guy is crime money is not what this guy is, like, in this for at all. He's in this, like, to do, like, weird... I mean, I don't want to... Well, I mean, I guess he is a terrorist, but, like...
Oh, yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like, this guy's plans are, like, bigger than any, like, Mr. Freeze or Riddler. Like, this guy is, like, in it for something much higher than that.
Yeah.
And you
yeah.
get that in his execution, in his technique, and his all of his planning. Like, it's not heists he's after.
Yeah, by the time you get to the end of that sequence, it perfectly illustrates, like, what a... a just like tsunami of terror this guy is, you know, and just goes, okay, this is just the tip of the iceberg of what this guy can do, and he's coming to Gotham, you know. And I love the final bit of that sequence where his you know, to kind of reset your mind on Batman, you know, after this whole scene of watching Bane, you know, be Bane, the moment that kind of sells you on, okay, this guy is going to be a match for Batman. Not a single word is said. It's just the shot of him using the skyhook that Batman used in The Dark Knight to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
That's such a brilliant, just like subtle little way of just kind of going like, okay, this guy knows what's up.
How about you, Daryl? What do you think of his first impression?
Yeah, I mean, that one sequence shows you just how intelligent, ruthless, and efficient he can be all in one. In one swift stroke. I mean, the why would you shoot a guy before tossing him out of a plane? That tells you right there, all right, this dude pays attention. He's observant to what's going on, and he knows what questions to ask. He's got the smarts. And then just his physical presence alone lets you know that he's formidable and not to be messed with. And the whole, like you said, the blood transfusion, the leaving that guy behind to expect to find somebody in the wreckage. He's cold, calculating, cunning, and completely intelligent. And the way they convey that in a very small period of time is a testament to excellent writing.
Well, and also the thing I love about what you were saying is Bane is like the most Captain Practical villain in this movie. You know, like later on when Gordon gets away in the sewers and all the henchmen are like, oh, he's dead. It's like, oh, show me the body. You know, like he's aware that he's in a movie in a weird way.
Yeah, Bane has watched way too much X-Files. He knows exactly. That if there's no body, they're not dead.
Well, and even at the very end, you know, after Talia leaves and, you know, tells him, hey, you know, don't kill him, I want him to burn. You know, he just goes, yeah, we both know that's not going to happen.
Yeah, it does a fantastic job of setting up Bane, as we all said, as like a dude who's just beyond formidable, and it really makes us anticipate that fight.
Oh, yeah.
especially a little later on when we see Batman watching Bane over the, you know, over one of the security cams from the, from Wall Street. The Gotham Stock Exchange. We're not in New York, technically. you know, as he's watching him and like... Alfred, being as encouraging as ever, is like, look at that. Efficiency, strength. He could kick your ass, Wayne. And Batman, I loved Batman's response during that, where he's just like, well, I'll just fight harder.
Yeah.
Yeah. Worst way you can answer that, like, Alfred just comes out with a complete speech of, yeah, look at his speed, his ferocity, his dedication to what he's trying to do, and Bruce...
I see the, like, League of Shadows resurgent.
Yeah, Bruce, like, yeah, I'll just punch him a couple times harder than I normally would. It was a terrible, terrible strategy. Well, I don't think Bruce really had a strategy going in against Bang. I think he really wanted to try and punch his way out of that, and he quickly found out that that wasn't going to work against Bang.
Well, I'm just picturing that... Go ahead, Ian.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that's kind of the point, though, is that by that you know, point in Bruce Wayne's life, he just kind of doesn't give a shit anymore.
Oh yeah, that's also a good point.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm just picturing that in full Batman voice, like, how do you think you're going to fight him? I'm just going to beat him up. I'm just going to beat him up. Going to fight him good. he's going to fight good. I'm going to fight better.
Like, sir, did you see that motorcycle helmet he had?
Yeah, well, obviously I'll take that off of him first, and then I'll beat him up.
It was a ruby the size of a tangerine.
No, but I love their interactions. And actually, that's the next thing we should talk about, probably, is the interactions between Alfred and kind of the older Bruce Wayne after the fact. Because that's another callback to Dark Knight, as they talk about basically what happened with Rachel. What do you guys think of... Yeah, very awkward. What do you guys think about the inclusion of that plot element, and how do you think it was handled?
I did not like how it was handled. Actually, for me, that whole, you know, where they're standing in the hallway talking to each other and Alfred's telling me, you know, what if there was a note? What if I burned that note? There's something about it I didn't really like, man. Michael Caine's performance came off a little bit too hammy for me in that scene. That being said, I think it's having a Batman without an Alfred is just weird to me. And so to see them, like, split ways, I feel like if you follow traditional storytelling elements, that split should have happened in The Dark Knight, only for Alfred and Batman to come back together to defeat Bane in the third movie. But they decided to do the split in the third movie. It takes Alfred off the board for pretty much 75% of the movie. You don't get your Alfred, which is, I had a little bit of problem with that. But that one scene in particular just seemed a little bit hammy and forced into the plot.
Yeah, I've got to agree in that sense. I think this movie suffers a little bit from its... Yeah, you know, I'm not entirely sure how to phrase it. I think this movie... Ian, go ahead. I'll get back to that.
I was just going to say, I absolutely love that scene. I honestly, I think Michael Caine is fantastic in that, because, you know, you just get that sense, you know, that he conveys that this is kind of, in a way, his whole world is kind of falling apart, you know, that his whole life up to this point has been about taking care of this kid, you know, and keeping him out of danger. And he even has that line where he's like, look, I know what this means, but, you know, if there's any way that this can, you know, this can keep you alive, I'm going to do it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think parts of the plot suffer a little bit in the writing. I think it's clear that this movie was... It has to do a little more cleanup work than I think they wanted to. I think because Dark Knight was such a success, maybe because they didn't have Heath Ledger anymore, something happened that I think this movie got rushed a tiny bit. And maybe not in the filming aspect, but I think in the writing aspect. And I think some of those, you know, honestly, maybe they just tried to do too much. I'm not entirely sure. But I think some of those plot lines didn't really need to get finished or got finished in ways that I disagree with. And I'm not sure how some of them really connect together. This movie, I think, for me, for the most part, is a series of really awesome moments. And there are a lot of awesome moments. The police marching on the abandoned city hall scene where they all clash. You know, the whole Catwoman Batman team up fight, both in the sewers and on the rooftop. The, you know, my mother warned me about getting in cars with strange men. This isn't a car. You know, that whole exchange. the Bane Batman fight scene. You know, there's a lot of really cool moments. I just don't know if it all strings together to create the tightest plot possible.
Yeah, really, I wish they would have tied up the whole Rachel thing in The Dark Knight. I get that they were running long because Dark Knight's a fairly long flick, and so they wanted to go on ahead and you know get to the end and get it you know concluded. But I wish they would have resolved the whole Rachel thing in The Dark Knight and left the focus on Bane and Talia Ghul and Daggett and all that kind of stuff in The Dark Knight Rises. I think that was one extra element that didn't really need to be there.
Well, I think with what kind of you're talking about, you know, the at least the source of that problem that you have, where that might be coming from, is the fact that with all three of these movies, Nolan didn't really plan on there being sequels or him making them. So like when he made The Dark Knight, he wasn't really planning on, okay, and then in the next movie we're going to tell a Bane story and all that. So I feel like, you know, maybe what you're saying is maybe a little systemic of the fact that, you know, they just kind of went for broke and they weren't really forward thinking as far as, okay, how are we going to deal with this in the next movie?
Yeah, I could agree to that. And yeah, you know, that makes sense because it doesn't seem like there's any foreshadowing in any of these movies that leads into the next one, so to speak. Yeah, there is, of course, at the end of Batman Begins, where they're talking about issues of escalation. But there's nothing in The Dark Knight that really, like, you know, it could end at Dark Knight. It could, hypothetically.
You know, in their minds, it kind of did while they were making it.
Yeah, and in that sense, a lot of this movie kind of feels a tiny bit like an afterthought. And look, it's a good movie and I really enjoy it, but there are some stuff I disagree with in the execution. And I think the whole Rachel note scene might be one of them. I think, yeah, as Daryl said, that could be resolved at the end of Dark Knight. In some way, or implied to be brought up halfway through. But in the middle of the movie, like at the end of the first act, it just kind of feels like a leftover of a movie that we kind of resolved in the first 5 minutes of this movie. And I'm not sure I really liked the execution of that.
Yeah, I can agree with that. As far as them not realizing that they were going to do this third movie, because yeah, now that you mention it, Ian, I do remember they were like, we'll figure something out. Them attempting to bring back Ra's al Ghul, Liam Neeson, into the fold, and you know that cut back to when him and Bruce are speaking in Batman Begins, and you know, I had a wife, she was taken from me, and all that kind of good stuff. I'm still not sure if that was, well, you know, leaving themselves a back door, or if they went back and said, hey, you know what, we might be able to exploit that, and throw that, yeah. But. When that happened, the first time I saw it in theaters, I was like, this seems like a little forced, a forced way to tie it all together. Now, it was much better done here than it was, say, in Spectre, when they tried to force Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace and Skyfall and all that in there. But that was something I thought was, in The Dark Knight Rises, a little much. I appreciate the attempt that they tried to throw it in there, but it seemed like another thing that might have been just a little too much to try and tie it all in together. I'm not sure that was any kind of strange pressure they felt because Marvel was tying all their business already together, and they're like, well, we got to figure out some kind of way to tie this little universe together, or if Nolan consciously said, hey, well, you know, here's something we can use, let's use it.
Yeah, I think it's more the second thing, you know, more the fact that, again, they went into this movie going, you know, Nolan was very vocal before he signed on to do this of, look, I'm not going to do a third movie just to do a third movie. I don't want to do another one and have it just be another Batman movie. If I'm going to make a third Batman movie, there has to be a reason in the story that it exists. And ultimately, the reason that he came upon was making this film an ending. And so I feel like, you know, a lot of what you're talking about kind of going back to the first two movies and sort of tying back into that, it comes from that place of, okay, how do we end this story? How do we bring this full circle to where we began it and kind of close this loop, basically?
I can get down with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what makes these three movies pretty distinct, because Batman Begins, for the most part, is a real superhero movie. He's literally fighting a masked menace who has a fear weapon, you know, and a clan of ninjas and all that jazz. The Dark Knight is a heavy detective movie. You know, he's digging into people's aliases. He's putting together clues that Joker's leaving in newspapers. And then this movie covers the angle of Batman that's a real, well, it's a team-up story, which is a classic Batman thing. You know, if you were to see this as a comic book cover, you know, what would it be? You know, you know, The Dark Knight Rises featuring Catwoman in this issue, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
And in the corner it'd have, and introducing Robin.
Yeah, and introducing Joseph Gordon-Levitt as, I guess, Robin. I have disagreements about how they handled that. I think it was super dumb that they just called him Robin.
I feel like that was Nolan being like, all right, I'll throw you guys a bone. I'll give you something.
Sure. Well, we can get into that later. But, like, yeah, no, this is a really good team-up Batman movie. Because he does. He has, you know, this movie is almost defined more by his allies. Whether it's very literally Catwoman and Commissioner Gordon, or it's, like, even the guy in the prison who, like, tells him what's going on and fixes his back. Batman can only get through this with the help of, like, his, and this number I don't think is an exaggeration, like, 6 or 7 allies. You know, Gordon, Fox, Catwoman, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, whose name I don't remember, Alfred, dude inside the pit, and I guess Talia for half of it.
Yeah, well, that's what I was talking about, making the Lawrence of Arabia comparison at the beginning. I wasn't kidding. Like, it's... You know, it's an epic as far as, you know, in scale, but also in its cast. You know, this film is very much an ensemble, more so than the first two.
Yeah. When I was writing my notes for my own podcast that I have to do, considering this movie, one of the notes that I wrote was, had this been a comic book, like we were just saying, this is definitely one that would have benefited from the extended Bat family. Like, if this was going down mm-hmm. in the comic books, you would have needed the Damian Wayne and a Nightwing and an Oracle and Red Hood. Like, I feel like they all would have came together and in order to stop Crazy Bane and Talia al Ghul running around, you know, doing what they were doing. It would have been more than just, well, I guess, like in like you guys were saying with Gordon and with, I think his name was Blake. Was Joseph Gordon?
Yeah, John Blake.
Yeah, John Blake. And, you know, and the underground cops and Catwoman and all that kind of stuff. I guess they're kind of stand-ins for the Bat family there. But had this been a comic book, this definitely would have been an extended Bat family story.
Yeah, it would have been like a 6-part crossover, kind of like Death in the the recent, like, A Death in the Family or something.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it really does showcase, like, what everyone can bring to the table. Commissioner Gordon can provide him with different information than Officer Blake can. Officer Blake can do different things for him than Catwoman can. You know, they're all working on different parts of the case, so to speak, different parts of the mission, so to speak. Not all in tangent with each other, and, you know, they don't all know each other exists. You know, I don't think Blake is aware Catwoman is real, or anything like that. And they don't know they're all on the same team, but they kind of end up being that way by the end, especially very literally when Batman's actually sending people out to do things. You know, he's like, Catwoman needs to clear the debris. Commissioner Gordon needs to lead the charge to take out the bomb. Officer Blake needs to evacuate people. You know, it comes together in a really cool way that's truly a team-up issue. And then very literally, him and Catwoman fighting their way through the sewer is just a fantastic sequence.
Yes.
Well, and then that even extends to the ending, you know, as far as the things that he leaves behind, you know, as far as the continuing of the Batman legacy, you know, he leaves a little bit to each different person. Or if it's not a piece of that, you know, kind of the Batman legacy, it's, you know, a little note of, okay, I'm fine, and I'm going to let this person know that I'm fine. I'm going to leave this person a clue to know that I'm fine.
Hey, kid, you did a good job. Thanks. Thanks for nearly getting shot for me like 8 times. Appreciate it. Yours truly, the Batman.
Yeah, now here's my cave.
Honestly,
I don't know what you, how you guys, not to jump too far ahead, I don't know how you feel about the the end of the movie, but I absolutely love that personally. But
I am on the other side of that spectrum.
Really?
Yeah.
Debate.
What? Why? What is he going to do with that thing?
Well, I feel like that's sort of the point, though. Is the ending? The ending is more about, you know, making sure that Bruce can get out of this. You know, that he can now go off and live his life, you know, free of this. But at the same time, he's left enough behind that the people who are still in Gotham can keep going. That, you know, whether at the end, whether John Blake becomes Robin, whether he becomes Batman or Nightwing or anything else, it's not really the point. The point of that is that he's left in the keys of the kingdom, you know, and then he goes, okay, you know, it's up to you now. You know, but the point is that there'll always be some sort of a protector of Gotham. You know, that the idea of Batman lives on, even if it's not necessarily the Bruce Wayne Batman.
When it first came out, the first thought I've had, and the thought I've had throughout all these years up until watching it today, was if he is passing along the Batman mantle to Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who's had no real training of any kind or whatever, if he suits up, if his first night out there, he's going to get stomped out and tossed off a roof.
No. He doesn't need to be as good. I'm just saying that's why I said it's more about leaving him the keys to the kingdom than giving him the suit and going, okay, kid, now suit up and go out there.
Now, with that being said, I never really thought about it until you just said leaving him the keys to the kingdom. Earlier in the movie, Alfred was chiding Bruce when Bruce is down in the Batcave, saying, you know, the cops would be able to do their job if you gave them the technology. So yep. If that's what he's doing, yeah. Pass it along to not a potential Robin, but to a cop to give Gotham CDPD the tools they need to be more successful in his wake, that I'm 100% on board with, and I'm kind of ashamed that it just took until now for me to realize that.
And that's the thing, that what you're talking about is kind of very subtly kind of laid out throughout the movie, where at different points you have people telling Bruce, you know, hey, if, you know, the time of you being Batman, it's done. You know, if you want to do good for the city, you know, give them your resources. You know, Alfred says, you know, yeah, you know, give them your knowledge, your resources. You know, they don't need your life. And then later, you know, Talia says a very similar thing, that, you know, if you want to save this city, if you want to save these people, you need to start trusting them, mm-hmm. You know? And so I feel like that specifically that final act of, you know, leaving Gordon the bat signal, you know, giving Blake the coordinates to get into the cave, you know, is all of this, you know, one kind of grand notion of him going, okay, you know, people of Gotham, you know, the idea of Batman's going to live on, how you want to go about implementing that, I'm leaving that up to you. But now I'm walking away.
Especially since we see basically kind of the perversions of his technology as well, because as you said, we see the Skyhook being used by Bane in the beginning.
Yes.
You know, we see the tumblers guarding the streets of Anarchy Gotham. You know, we see what happens when his technology gets into the wrong hands. So it's interesting to see him. Well, you know, it's actually very, you know, validating to see him finally put it in the right hands.
Although he is kind of justified. The whole reason he didn't want to give stuff up is he feared what would happen if it fell into the wrong hands. And we see in this movie kind of what happens when his stuff falls into the wrong hands. So I see both sides of the coin there.
Well, it's what you were saying. It was about it falling into the wrong hands. You know, it was going to people that he didn't trust versus at the end of the movie, leaving all of that stuff to his most, you know, trusted confidants, you know, to the people who were there at the funeral.
Sure, sure. But the way corruption works in Gotham, you never know how quickly those could get into the wrong hands as well.
But that's the thing is, you know, and I feel like that's even something they brought up in The Dark Knight, is that, like, you can't just, you know, even though Bruce Wayne wants to give up being Batman, you can't just suddenly stop being Batman. You know, you can't take that out of Gotham now. There's always going to be, you know, due to escalation, there's always going to be this perpetual cycle of violence and corruption. And at the end of the day, there needs to be that check there to kind of keep that in line. And that's at the end of the day, that's what he's doing at the end of the movie, is making sure that, okay, if I'm not going to do this anymore, I'm going to give the right people the right tools to basically keep things in line.
Right. No, it makes sense to me.
Yep.
I will say though, I really do. Donald and I got in a little bit of a disagreement in the Batman Begins episode over whether or not John Blake really counted as a Robin or not. However briefly, where do you guys stand on that? Because I don't think he's Robin. I know they give him the name Robin. Why don't you check my legal name? Oh, I like it. You should keep it Robin. I think that's nothing more than just like a real cheesy cameo, and I don't put any stock in that, because he doesn't do any Robin-like activities. And just because he's the successor to Batman, that doesn't really make him a Robin.
Yeah, I think that's really is more of yeah, Nolan kind of throwing a bone to the fans, you know, and in a way kind of reverse engineering that moment earlier where Blake is about to be executed and then Batman drops down and, you know, Blake gets a couple licks in on one of the guys where that scene, that's your Batman and Robin. That's the closest you're going to get to that in the Nolan verse. And no, is he supposed to be like Robin? No, but it's there as just kind of a bone to throw to the fans to go, hey, you know, here you go, basically.
Sure. Daryl, where do you stand?
Pretty much right what Ian said. that scene of Robin getting a couple of licks in on one dude while Batman takes out the rest always reminds me of Iron Man 2, where Happy battles one guard while Black Widow carves through the rest of the hallway of guards. But yeah, he's definitely not a Tim Drake or a Dick Grayson or, you know, a Jason Todd or even a Damian Wayne. He's definitely not a Robin. He's a dude who helps out. You know, I'll give him that much. He's a dude who Batman trusts enough to you know, let him into the first level of the inner circle. But he is definitely not a Robin. It was definitely a bone thrown to the comic book heads or people who have been crying for Robin, especially when he said that there will be no Robin in my universe. And he stuck to that. There was no Robin in his universe. It was a dude who helped out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing, is I don't think he was even supposed to be a Robin, you know, like the whole purpose of his character, you know, and the way that character is written. I don't think they're trying to go, okay, let's make this Robin.
Yeah, I respect him a lot more as an original character than I do as a third of a Robin.
Yeah, no, which I don't think he is. I think this is an original character that, you know, much like how at the end, is he going to become Batman? Is he going to become something else? I feel like that's kind of the same thinking with making him Robin at the end. It's just we're just throwing this out there just as, you know, a nice kind of piece of connective tissue. But as far as how literal it is to the comic book, that doesn't really matter.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. So let's actually, you know, we've actually been talking a lot about structural plot issues and thematic issues. Let's just talk about, like, some of the performances real quick. What performances really stood out to you guys? Daryl, I'll start...
Hathaway.
Oh, sorry, Ian, I'll start with you,
quiet.
I guess.
No, I'll be quiet. Sorry, I got excited there.
Ian, go ahead.
I've got to go with Tom Hardy as Bane. I mean, that's what stands out for me the most. And strange enough, I'm not sure the actor's name, but the guy who plays Daggett played a very slimy dude very well. He has a very punchable face to him, so I'm not sure if that was a great casting or a great performance on his part. but I gotta give my props to Tom Hardy as Bane. He's my number one standout.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got to agree with Daggett. They do a really good job throughout this movie kind of explaining, showing why he's awful. You know, the entire boardroom exchange where he's just like, excuse me, what is Bruce Wayne doing here? You know, where he's like, and, you know, Lucius Fox is like, his name's on the fucking company wall. What are you talking about? And it's like, really? Are we sure we want to talk to this guy? You know, where he's just being an ass to Bruce Wayne, you know, over a crime that he manufactured, obviously.
Yeah.
Like talk about being two-faced. I mean, that guy's like, you know, like triple crossing people. But also, like, you get a really cool idea, like, even in, like, this isn't a reflection of him exactly, because it's different characters, but that scene in the stock exchange right before the heist takes place, when you see all of those, like, young Wall Street execs, like, just being dicks to the service employees,
mm-hmm.
You know, like, tossing money on the ground to the shoeshine dude and just walking over the area that the guy just mopped, like, those guys are kind of an extension of Daggett, an extension of the whole, you know, well, I mean, look, this movie is very, you know, we are the one, or we are the 99%, you know, Occupy Wall Street. It's got a lot of those kind of themes in it. So you can kind of see those guys as a logical extension of Daggett.
Yeah, I agree with that. Speaking of the boardroom, I'm not sure if he's in all three movies, but I got to give a shout out to the old guy with the white hair that's always on the board. That dude has like infinite loyalty to the Waynes, and that, I always love his little two bits.
That's thing. Actually, oh sorry.
Oh, what were you gonna say?
I was gonna say that's actually Christopher Nolan's uncle,
really?
And yeah, he's also in Batman Begins in that same role, and he pops up in a couple of his other movies.
Nice. Yeah, I kind of get the impression that guy worked with Thomas Wayne directly or something.
Yeah, that's the impression I always get. And I will say this for me is Gary Oldman's best performance as Commissioner Gordon.
Oh, man, he's so good.
Yeah. That's all I got.
Well, going back to what you were saying about Daggett and Tom Hardy, the scene that always... It both cracks me up, but it is also like legitimately a really intense scene. Is the scene where Bane kills Daggett?
Yes.
And just that moment where he's like, you know, where he tells the one guy, he's like, leave us, and then Daggett's like, no, you stay here, I'm in charge. He doesn't grab him, he doesn't punch him, he just sets his hand on his shoulder, and the guy just turns around and just leaves. He's like, all right, I'm gonna go now.
That is probably my second or third favorite Bane scene. And it's a running joke amongst me and my friends when one of us is getting too rowdy. We'll just put a hand on the other's shoulder. And we know exactly what I mean. All right, calm down.
And then do you feel in charge?
Yeah.
So, Ian, I think you were gunning for Catwoman earlier.
Oh, my God, do I love Anne Hathaway in this movie.
Go on.
No, seriously, like, in all honesty, it's like, she nails, as far as, like, what you picture reading the comics, like, the way that Catwoman would, you know, just her cadence and the way that she would carry herself and just that kind of very femme fatale way that character is often written, she just nails that, like, right off the bat. Because there's that moment early on in the movie when she first meets Bruce Wayne and she's playing the role of, you know, the mousy kind of, you know, dowdy maid. And then there's that moment, right, where Bruce basically calls her on her shit, where her whole body language changes, her whole demeanor changes, and right there, you know in that, what, 7 seconds, who this character is?
Oops. That whole bit, yeah.
Purely from body language.
I hope you all wanted to hear my diseased voice try to do a sexy Anne Hathaway voice.
Oh, that was great.
That's what the listeners pay for free.
But no, and going back to Tom Hardy, you gotta imagine like what a thankless task that was, as far as, okay, you're the villain in the new Batman movie, but you're following up Heath Ledger.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yikes.
And the fact that both in the writing of the character and in Hardy's performance of the character, they go the complete opposite direction of the Joker. That he is a wildly different character. You know, he's this much more both a physical threat, but also a maniacal madman. You know, he's this calculating mastermind.
Yeah, I agree with that, and the fact that they handicapped him. He was coming off of, you know, an Oscar-winning performance there with Joker, and, you know, one of the most beloved both characters and performances in a comic book movie. And then they put him in this, and not only do they put him in that coming off of that, but they're like, and you only get your eyes to emote with. Most of your face is going to be covered up. So that handicaps a lot of his acting ability, too. He has to do everything through his eyes and through a voice that's not even his voice. It's a voice that's modulated. And so he really had an upward climb to nail this role.
Well, and even that, though, with what you're saying about his eyes, it really, you know, stuck out to me this last time watching the movie was how much of his performance really is expressed through his eyes and through the way that he carries himself. And even in certain scenes where he's not even moving, just the way that he stands in the corner of a room, you know, and just stares at people,
mm-hmm.
You know, just he has so much just power and commands so much attention And, you know, even early on in the airplane scene, you know, just with his eyes, you know, you get the sense really quickly that, like, oh, this guy isn't fucking around at all. Like, this dude's fucking crazy.
Yeah, there is a lot of great body language in there. A lot of when he's standing, he's got that thing going on where he's kind of got his thumbs underneath his tactical vest.
I have something to say about that.
He always looks like a quarterback on the sidelines.
No. What that is, that's a callback to Batman Begins. Because, again, something I wouldn't have noticed if I hadn't watched all three of these movies at once. When Liam Neeson is training Bruce Wayne, you know, in the League of Shadows, and he's kind of walking him around, showing him, you know, the explosive powder and all that. It's mostly in that sequence, that section of the movie. Liam Neeson does this thing where he's kind of walking around and he's holding the lapels of his jacket, you know, in that same way. So really what Tom Hardy's doing when he's walking around kind of holding the straps on his jacket is a callback to Ra's al Ghul, because that's an affectation that Liam Neeson did in that performance.
God, that's brilliant.
Yeah, you know, go back and watch it again. It's there. There's a lot of that. Like, even just the idea of the prison essentially being a large version of the well from Batman Begins, you know, with the bats and everything, and even the way that they shoot a lot of the shots looking up from the bottom of the pit to the top are kind of mirror shots of the way that the well shots are done in Batman Begins. You know, where in Begins, the camera would be looking up and it'd be slightly moving to the right. When in Rises, when it's looking up the pit, it's similar composition, but the camera's slightly moving left. There's so much little stuff like that that you never pick up on.
God, I could talk about this trilogy of movies forever, and, you know, but, like, there's literally so much to discuss.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, we barely touched upon the Lazarus Pit at all. Which I think was, you know, I think is a really good way to bring in that very insane comic booky element. You know, because look, you couldn't include the actual Lazarus Pit in this movie at all. It wouldn't make sense in this world.
No, it would break that sense of reality that they've spent so long trying to establish.
Yeah, as soon as you decide that the Joker isn't actually dyed, you know, bright white with, you know, green hair due to a chemical accident. You know, as soon as you decide that that has to be makeup, you can't really have a giant, like, you know, vat of chemicals that resurrects the dead. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, once you cut out that little leap, you can't really, you know, use that big leap later on.
But it works. It works as more of a thematic Lazarus Pit.
Yeah, yeah, because he is resurrected in a different way.
Yeah, as he go, you know, he goes in there a broken man and all that, you know, completely broken down to the core. And then it's kind of the cultivation of what I was talking about with the sort of deconstructionist attitude of the movie is, you know, he basically, you know, yeah, he rises out of this pit, you know, much like he did in Batman Begins, you know, emerging from this well, emerging from these bats, now kind of reformed, refocused, you know, as far as kind of who Batman is and what Batman is.
And he does it without his father, too. He has to climb himself out as well.
Yes, and that's it. Oh, God, I love this movie. Because, yeah, they even have that callback to, you know, where he has that brief flashback of his father coming down to the well to lift him out. And, yeah, even having that of, okay, you got to do it, but you got to do it without the harness. And it's him doing what he couldn't do when he was a kid of himself climbing out of that well and confronting those bats, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, no, it's obviously a very metaphorical, you know, resurrection. You know, you get the idea that Talia's mother entered as, you know, Talia's mother and Talia came out as a result. You know, Bane came in as whoever he was before Bane and came out as Bane as a result. You know, it's part of Henry Ducard's transformation into Ra's al Ghul, even if he didn't actually go into the pit himself. Bruce Wayne reemerges as Batman. Like, it's a very literal resurrection, but, you know, through metaphor.
I would disagree with that. I would say that Batman reemerges as Bruce. Like, he throws on the suit to finish it up with Bane, but after that, you know, it's all said and done.
Well, and I think it's also interesting. I don't know if it actually really means anything on a subtextual level. But I do think it's really interesting that the final fight that he has with Bane in this movie is in broad daylight, which nothing else in any of the other movies in this series have had. It's always him lurking in the shadows, him at night. And then post him coming out of the pit, it's him on a city street in broad daylight fighting Bane.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I don't know. Again, I don't know if that's actually supposed to mean anything or if it's just a coincidence. But
I think it does because, you know, what's Bane's whole speech during their first fight? You think you were born in the darkness.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I never put that together.
Yeah, where Bane keeps saying, darkness is my advantage. I'm meant to fight in the darkness. And, you know, that's Batman's entire strategy. So Batman just, you know, reverses it on him. Is like, okay, I'll fight you right in the broad daylight. I'll fight you in front of everyone where they can recognize their symbol of truth and justice versus a person who has brought their city into chaos and poverty in the last 6 months.
This is why I love this movie, because there's so many little things like that that I never would have noticed, that I never would have picked up on.
And then, obviously, an extension of that, you get that beautiful scene of all the cops in uniform, you know, rushing the armed terrorists, you know, in that literal clash, you know, Batman swoops in. He's making himself a very visible symbol. He's not just the legend anymore. You know, people don't just like, hey, did you hear what the Batman did? It's everyone can see in broad daylight what he's doing for them right now.
Which I think goes back to the whole theme of the ending of the movie of him giving, you know, giving it up and leaving them the keys to the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And also, just a small side note, I love that during that, Bane and Batman are doing nothing but beating the shit out of other people just to find each other.
Yeah.
I love that.
Sorry, I don't mean to keep dragging on about this, but, more that just occurred to me. Yeah, it takes him out of the legend status, but it gives him a level of validation. You know, they put up his statue in City Hall. Everyone can see him flying off into the distance. He's like national, you know, he's recognized officially by the city. He's working with the cops instead of being the antagonist to the cops.
Well, and just a random, a little note. Did you notice the color of the cloth that they had on the statue when they unveiled it?
No, I didn't.
It's the, it's that classic color of blue that the cape was, that like really, it's difficult to describe, that like deep blue that the cape always was back in like the early Bill Finger era.
Yeah. The 1970s Jim Aparo costume.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the tint of blue that that they had over the statue.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, no, he literally brings the fight into the light and he legitimizes himself as part of Gotham.
Also, how awesome is that fight?
Yeah, he's no longer the dead legend, he's real.
Also, I love that fight, literally just the second half of it, is just him kicking the shit out of Bane.
Yeah, and that's such a good twist, too. That's such an interesting plot twist as well.
Yeah.
Talia. Talia being revealed.
Not just because of the Talia reveal, but because, I don't know if you felt this way, but the first time I saw it, you feel weirdly kind of, you feel some level of empathy towards Bane.
Oh, yeah, no, you absolutely do. It's a high angle looking down. He's wheezing a bit. You know, he's off his guard. And, like, this guy is a horrible terrorist who has just caused the death of probably thousands of people. Like, you briefly feel bad for him in his weakened state.
Well, I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about when we get the reveal, when we get the flashback into the pit.
Oh, yeah, that too.
You know, and you basically find out what Bane's deal is. Like, I kind of had this moment the first time I saw it where I was like, well, I'm getting a little choked up right now. And I feel kind of weird about that because, you know, I've been terrified of this guy for the last 2 hours. But, like, you kind of feel bad for him in a weird way.
Yeah, because I kind of got that same feeling as well. Basically, you think he is the henchman or you think he is the threat of this entire movie, and then at the very end, he's just reduced to nothing more than an over-glorified henchman. And you find out that he was nothing more than a tool that Talia al Ghul used. And, you know, for all his cold, cunning, calculated, you know, efficiency, he was just a pawn.
Yeah. And just that whole scene, I think, is great. And I love the moment when, right before she's about to hit the detonator, where just to kind of go to show how much Bruce loves this city, you know, where he's like basically like begging and pleading, you know, please don't do it. And then that moment of like, oh shit, it didn't work.
That's then, also a very comic booky thing.
Yeah.
Like the extension on the time bomb.
Yeah, but see, that's what I'm saying though, is it's like this movie is able to do these things where it's like, yeah, we have it's a bomb in a truck with a countdown timer that's going to blow up the whole city, and Batman is flying a plane after it, like shooting rockets and missiles at it, and I don't blink twice about it being ridiculous.
Yeah, no, it works. It works. So I think that closes up our discussion of this movie overall. Is there any final thoughts anyone wants to get in before we call it quits? Daryl, I'll start with you.
All right. Final thoughts. I mean, this is the end cap to one of the better trilogies we've had in the last couple of years. Honestly, I can't think of any other trilogies that are in this weight class. What Nolan managed to do with this franchise is take, you know, obviously it took a couple of years off, but he just completely removed the funk of the Schumacher era off of Batman when he brought it back to a gritty realism. It made you really think that, yeah, somebody who's crazy enough and had enough money could actually possibly pull this stuff off. And I think that gritty realism might have inadvertently been part of Warner Brothers and DC's misstep, I want to call it, maybe, in Man of Steel and in Batman vs. Superman. I think that Nolan did these movies and grounded them in realism and darkness so well that when it came time for Man of Steel and when it came time for Batman vs. Superman, they tried to emulate that, and it just didn't work. It didn't work to their advantage at all. Which is a testament to how good this trilogy is.
Yeah, I'm kind of on the record agreeing with you on that I think that Man of Steel and to a similar extent, although maybe more so, Arrow, and those kind of shows that were almost, you know, legacies of this didn't really work out because it didn't really need to have the same groundedness that this movie had.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I think this is a fantastic end cap to the trilogy, and it really does work for the character. I said earlier that I think the story is a little more moments, less story, but you know, by the time it gets to the end, it really all does come together for one fantastic end to the tale of Batman.
Yeah.
Ian, how about you?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, this is, you know, honestly, this is one of my favorite, if not maybe my favorite, like just single movie trilogy, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like what this movie does so well is just that, is cap off this story in such a beautiful way, you know, that, you know, this is going to sound so stupid, but every time I watch this movie, every single time, and it gets to that ending, and Alfred sees Bruce in the cafe and all that. I'm not gonna lie, I get kind of choked up every time I watch it, you know, because as a longtime Batman fan, it seems like every iteration of Batman kind of ends on this note of like, well, I guess I'll go keep being depressed and I'm gonna go be Batman again. So if you need me, just throw the signal up, you know. And especially with this iteration of Bruce Wayne in this story, you know, I don't know, it just ending it on that note, it feels so right, you know, that even kind of minor quibbles I might have with this movie, which are very few and far between, I'm willing to let slide because that ending works so well, you know, and not just that scene. I you know, when I say the ending, I mean the last like 45 minutes of this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that concludes our discussion of The Dark Knight Rises. Anything anyone else wants to throw in at the last possible second?
I got nothing.
All right.
If you have a chance to do the marathon, do the marathon.
Oh boy! Look, Ian. You know, someday I really want to. Next time I'm in Austin.
Well, no, I'm just saying in general, like, because if you have like an afternoon, watch all three movies.
Oh, I know, but I need you to point out all the special things to me.
Oh, I will. Well, that's the thing is Rises especially benefits the most in ways that you would not even begin to understand unless you've watched them all in like relatively close succession.
All right. Fair enough. Well, that concludes our discussion of The Dark Knight Rises. We're going to get to commercial real quick, and then we'll be right back to talk about some comics.
Hey, Infinity Break fans. Do you want to show your support and devotion for an extremely obscure group of entertainers? Well, now you can. Just go to our website at infinitybreak.net and click on the shop tab to be whisked away to our Redbubble, where you can find all sorts of awesome shirts, stickers, notebooks, and other gadgets decked out with icons from all of our most popular shows. Act now, because that stuff will be there forever.
Alright, obviously we love comic book movies, but that stems from our love of comic books. So, let's talk about what we've been reading. Now, Ian, you actually hate comic books with a burning passion still, right?
Yeah, fuck you too.
Alright, cool. Daryl, what have you been reading?
You know what? I went old school a couple days ago in prep for my own podcast. I went back and read a highly touted joint that everyone seems to love. Superman for All Seasons.
Oh, yeah, I have that. I need to read it.
Yeah, never read it before because I hate Superman, just as an idea.
As a character.
Yeah, I am not a Superman fan in the slightest, but because I'm doing a podcast where I compare comic book movies to comic books, I needed something to compare to the very first Christopher Reeve Superman movie. So I decided to go with Superman for All Seasons. It was much better than I thought it was going to be. Actually, Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale, who, if you know them, they did The Long Halloween. You're going to go on the Batman theme. And they did the Spider-Man Blue, the Captain America White, the Hulk Gray, all those kinds of stuff. They have a history of great team-ups, and this is another solid entry. I think, like, early 2000s or late 90s or something like that is when they did this story. And, you know, it's four volumes. It follows the four seasons. That's hence the title, Superman for All Seasons. It follows spring, summer, fall, winter is how it goes. And if you watch Superman the movie and then read this, if you do those two things back to back like I did, you realize that in the comic book there are so many callbacks to that movie that it's insane. And much as I don't like Superman, I loved that comic book.
Well, I'm sure you'll come around to him eventually.
I've hated Superman for 34 years, sir.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
I've loved him for like 10? I don't know. look, you know my Twitter avatar. You know what I'm into.
Oh, yeah. It's quite obvious that you're a Superman dude. I've always been more of a Batman guy. That's where I fall. There's a lot of problems I have with Supes that I haven't seen fixed yet, but that's my own personal business.
All right, fair enough. Well, weirdly, on a counterpoint, I've actually been playing a lot of Arkham City, although that is not a comic book. But because of that and a combination of Luke Cage, I actually haven't had a ton of time to read comics, although I do not hate them with a burning passion like Ian does.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck off.
But I have had the... come again, sir?
Oh, nothing. No.
All right. Wasn't quite sure I heard you. Speaking of Luke Cage, I have actually gone back and I have started to read the very recent series of Power Man and Iron Fist that came out earlier this year. A fun comic, really, really stylistic. It is by, let me zoom in on the title.
I think Sanford Green is the guy that's doing the artwork for it, but I...
yeah, you are correct.
Can't remember who's actually writing it. I got a chance to kick it with Sanford Green a couple of months ago. Real cool guy.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
It's by him and a gentleman named Walker. It is a really stylistic book. It's gorgeous. Just looking at the cover for the first issue alone, the way he draws both Luke Cage and Iron Fist is really unique. You know, Iron Fist, you know, has your kind of standard athletic superhero build, but like Luke Cage is, you know, absolutely built. He's got like, you know, clear upward lines. It's just, you know, it's gorgeous. Like these characters are almost caricature at this point with the way they're drawn. And it comes in later, you know, as you see more and more of the surrounding cast. And it's kind of a great all-encompassing throwback to the history of both of those characters. It's got a really unique aesthetic to it that, you know, ropes in a lot of the kind of underground crime aspects of the Marvel Universe, which is actually one of my more favorite ends, you know. Like, the Hood's got a cameo in it. It's got some old, you know, kind of Luke Cage villains in it. Iron Fist is an absolute delight as he kind of goes back and forth with his standard, you know, his standard nonsense with Luke Cage. And you really get the idea of a solid friendship in between. And because I like both of those characters a lot, but I gotta confess, I'm not too familiar with any of their, you know, their villains or their origins to the same extent that I might be with, say, Daredevil. So it's kind of cool seeing this modern age story devoted to these two characters.
If you want a great Iron Fist story, the Immortal Iron Fist with Matt Fraction, and I think Brubaker yes. took it over after that. That is awesome. I read the first volume, and I got to the end of it, and I was like, I have no idea what just happened, but I loved it.
Yeah, that's the Mortal Kombat tournament, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the only Iron Fist story I've actually read. That is a gorgeous book in terms of art. I love how it incorporates, the ideas of that character's legacy and how it keeps cutting back to earlier time periods, stuff like that.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about, where it cuts back to like the Iron Fist of India, the Iron Fist of China.
Oh, yeah. I'm a huge fan of that book.
Yeah. Absolutely gorgeous story. Or excuse me, absolutely compelling story. Absolutely gorgeous art. Yeah, no, that's a fantastic story. I'm just not too familiar with like their original, like, you know, Heroes for Hire runs.
Okay. Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff.
Nor am I.
But yeah, so this is a really cool look into that kind of era of comics while obviously keeping everything updated and everything more just, you know, stylistically and narratively driven. It's absolutely a fantastic read so far. Only two issues are up on Marvel Unlimited. So I'm looking forward, you know, month to month as those continue to come out. But I also started Doctor Strange The Oath in anticipation for the movie, which I'm not going to see. So I'll more than likely be talking about Doctor Strange on our next episode. Ian, is there anything you might want to consider reading someday?
No. No, I'm kidding. Honestly, I am going to try probably this next week to run out to my local comic book shop and I don't know, probably blind buy some Doctor Strange stuff, just out of spite. Out of spite towards Ben, not out of spite towards the movie.
Wow. I love Doctor Strange. He's my third favorite character.
I know. It's just your issues with the movie, they continue to befuddle me is all.
All right. Well, anyway, that concludes up our comic book discussion. Gentlemen, thank you very much for both being on the show. Daryl, where can people find you on the internet? You have a very energetic and enthusiastic podcast, a couple, I believe.
Yeah. The Paprika Network. If you can just hop on the iTunes if you're an Apple guy and good search podcast. Poprika. There's a couple of shows in there. My buddy Eric hosts what we call the flagship, the Paprika Podcast. Used to be me, but then I took time off to work on my own comic book. So he's hosting it. I'm doing a show called Moving Panels where, you know, like I mentioned before, I look at doing 52 comic book movies, one every Monday. And I watch the movies. I read a comic that kind of ties in thematically with that. And then I rank each movie. So at the end of it, I will have my 52 best top to bottom comic book movies. Also, the Cine Automatics is another show that's on there. It's a DVD commentary joint, so you can sync us up while you're watching whatever the movie is and get my thoughts or our thoughts if I have a guest on there. And also doing a show called Collect Calls, which is pretty much my the chronicling of me making my comic book. So it's my behind-the-scenes struggles and triumphs and all that kind of good stuff. So anywhere you listen to podcasts, man, Paprika Podcast, Poprika. If you want to get in on discussion, man, there's a Facebook group, a Paprika Facebook group. You can go to facebook.com/groups/Paprika Podcast. And you'll find us in there. Go on and request to join and get in all the conversation we have going on there. And then you can find me on Twitter at CDelicious, CEEDLICIOUS. And that's pretty much it for me.
And I'm in that Facebook group if anyone wants to fight me. Sorry, I meant discuss, but whatever.
Hey, either or.
Yeah, no, I've listened to a couple episodes of Moving Panels. It's a really fun show. I need to check out the other ones, it sounds like.
Yeah, man, there's all sorts of wild shenanigans that go on the Paprika Network. We're looking to add a couple new shows, get some new voices in there, so it's not just my dulcet tones over and over and over again.
Oh, but you do have a beautiful podcasting voice.
Oh, thank you very much. Ian, I appreciate it.
I say while dying of the flu. Ian, what have you been working on?
Oh, Lord. You can find me also here on Infinity Break. I do A Brief History of Star Wars, which is, well, I mean, it's pretty much there in the title. It's myself and another guest kind of rambling on about usually a really shitty part of the Star Wars EU. And you can also find me on doubletoasted.com. And that's where. And oh, yeah, and Twitter and Instagram at the Ian Butcher, all one word.
Yeah. If you want to hear Ian and I talk about the made for TV Ewok movies, and I cannot imagine you would, that's the show to listen to. If you like Star Wars but hate all the good parts of Star Wars, that's the show for you. You can find me right here on InfinityBreak.net. I am the host of Roll With It, Super Cinema, and the Westport Saga, which should be coming back eventually. I am at Ben C. Hamlin on Twitter, in which I encourage you to talk Superman with me and agree with me that he is actually a fantastic comic book character, despite what others may attempt to say on my podcast. in the meantime, Super Cinema is every 2 weeks. Ian, what are we actually considering covering next week again?
I forgot.
Oh, me too. That's great.
I think we want to do
the Spider-Man movies.
Yeah, I was going to say, I want to say it was the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man, but I feel like there's something in between that we're forgetting. Dread.
I think there is. Oh, yeah, that's right. We're covering the Carl Urban Dread movie. Yes.
I just did that for my podcast 2 weeks ago, I think.
Oh, fancy that. I'll have to tune in.
Yeah,
we're going to be doing Dread, and then after that, we're going to be hitting up the Sam Raimi and then the Mark Webb Spider-Man films.
Excellent. Well, anyway, you can find me at Ben C. Hamlin on Twitter, and you can find all of our shows at InfinityBreak.net and InfinityBreak23 on all of our social media platforms. We've got about 8 podcasts, soon to be 9, with the addition of one later this month. But in the meantime, this has been Super Cinema. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
This podcast was part of Infinity Break, where we tell stories our own way. If you want to stay in the loop about what we do here at Infinity Break, you can find us on any social media platform at InfinityBreak23. That's Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram. If you like what we do here at Infinity Break, check out our other shows, comics, and videos at InfinityBreak.net and help spread the word by telling other people about our team. Leave a review on iTunes. The more 5-star reviews we have, the easier it is for people to find us and share in the infinite madness. Don't forget to check out our store under the Shop tab on our site, and if you're feeling generous, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/infinitybreak. Your monthly donation can help us improve the quality of this show and develop more shows for your listening and viewing pleasure. Until next time, Infinity Breakers, stay in the loop.